Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Dark Matters, Betrayal, by Michael Dow. Narrated by Graham Halstead. 1. The best way to keep one's word is not to give it. Napoleon Bonaparte. Pax heard the explosion before he saw it, or more precisely, before he saw the laboratory door, torn from its hinges and spiraling like a pinwheel past his head. The sound that followed was equally familiar, the roar of a growing fire and the rush of air being sucked through the doorway as the flames began to rob the lab of oxygen. He didn't have much time. Still, he remained on the floor for a moment more, processing this latest turn of events. The explosion had been a surprise, his third in less than an hour. It was some kind of record. The element of surprise was supposed to be part of his professional repertoire. But today, the roles had been reversed, and he had been the unsuspecting victim. Needless to say, it didn't sit well. Especially this last one. First, he had watched Monique Durand emerge from a taxi, stepping out of his past and into his present. It was a face he hadn't seen in years, with no conceivable link to his current operation. Or at least, so he had thought. She had been ancillary to another of his missions several years ago. She was the daughter of Claire Durand, a woman Pax had been hired to watch. Claire had died soon after, ending his assignment. Pax hadn't seen Monique since. From his vantage point across the street, Pax had watched Monique and another man enter Hansen Scientific. But this first surprise didn't deter him. True to his training, he had done some additional research, weighed his options, and made a decision. He adjusted the plan and pressed forward. The second surprise had been decidedly more problematic, and ended with his partner, Deuce, dead on the floor beside him. Monique had pinned Pax to the wall, using some kind of bizarre, unseen force that he didn't begin to understand. It was as if the wall had morphed into a giant magnet, and Pax had become 200 pounds of pure nickel. He was still coming to grips with the implications, none of which were particularly promising. Was it somehow related to Hansen's research? Professor Jonas Hansen was a run-of-the-mill physicist on the hunt for asteroids and likely well-versed in the properties of rare minerals. He and Monique didn't seem to know each other, but it was possible that the two of them were somehow connected. Why else would Monique have come to Hawaii to meet him? Pax might have found some answers here, on the computers in the lab, but smoke now billowed into the room. He didn't have the time. That brought Pax to the explosion, and the last of the morning's surprise trifecta. His employer must have rigged the building as a safeguard against the slim chance that Pax failed to complete the mission. It told him several things. First, that the mission outcome was more critical than he realized. And second, that his own survival wasn't. After all he had done for them, it was a bitter pill to swallow. But he filed the thought away. He had more pressing matters at hand. The explosion had sent a tremor through the entire building, though the initial damage to the lab appeared to be minimal. Pax remained crouched behind a bank of desks, where he had taken refuge after his negotiated truce with Monique. But now, flames had joined forces with the smoke, working their way up the wall on either side of the laboratory door. Time to move. Pax crawled across the floor to Deuce's body, grabbing her by the collar and dragging her to the far wall. Once there, he made quick work of the window, punching through the glass and clearing the fragments from around the frame. The glass was tempered and shatter-resistant, but his carbon alloy prosthetic arm barely registered the impact. The artificial skin around his hand felt the blow, but not the pain, and his hand came away without a scratch. Before climbing out, he activated Deuce's nanotech bodysuit, pulling the hood and mask over her head. It rendered her all but invisible. He had activated his own suit earlier as he dove away from the confrontation with Monique. Billions of nanofabric particles came to life, instantly absorbing and redirecting light waves as he moved. The particles were linked to hundreds of micro cameras embedded throughout the suit. Powerful processors converted images from the cameras into instructions for the nanoparticles, adapting the reflected light to mimic his immediate surroundings. The suits were one of the perks of his work with the consortium. Not even the military had access to this particular model. He slipped through the window, dragging Deuce's body behind him. Out in the alley, he paused, taking stock of his situation. There was no one else in sight. No sign of Monique or any of the others. His first priority was to get clear of the building and to return to his base of operations in the apartment across the street. There he could review the video feeds and access the rest of his equipment. Plus, he needed to dispose of Deuce's body. He lifted her by the waist, slinging her head first over his shoulder. Even without his prosthetic arm, she was a relatively light load. The alley emptied into a side street. He walked toward the main road, approaching cautiously and in the shadows of the still-burning building. A crowd had gathered, gawking at the now raging inferno that had been Hansen Scientific. The suits did their job, though. No one noticed their arrival. He crossed the street, arriving at the corner of the apartment building, again without incident. From there, however, his path became less certain as the gathering crowd now blocked the apartment entrance. The nanotech suits had a wide range of uses, but maneuvering through tight crowds wasn't one of them. The rapidly shifting visual field was too much, even for the suit's state-of-the-art processors. And physical contact, of course, would be a dead giveaway. He shifted Deuce's body, now holding her in front of him and wrapping his arm around her waist as if slow dancing. That would minimize the space they occupied. Then he waited, pressing them both against the side of the building. It took longer than he hoped, but he finally saw what he needed. A tall, stocky man, coffee in hand, striding purposefully down the sidewalk and toward the apartment door. The man passed their location, and Pax fell in step directly behind him, mimicking his pace and gait so close that Deuce all but brushed against the man from behind. With any luck, the crowd would part, the man wouldn't make any sudden or unexpected movements, and Pax would follow right behind him and into the building. His luck held. Pax slipped through the door just behind the man, stepping aside once inside. An elevator waited, and the man entered. When the doors closed, Pax tossed Deuce back over his shoulder and raced up the building stairwell. In less than a minute, he was back inside the apartment. He put Deuce's body into a hallway closet. The consortium would take care of that loose end. Right now, he needed to review the video feeds and consider his next steps. Pax replayed the videos, starting with the feed from inside the building. He shook his head in disbelief as he and Deuce were lifted as if by some invisible hand and launched into the laboratory wall. He heard the sickening crack again as Deuce's head collided with the solid surface. He watched the video up to the moment he had activated his bodysuit, disappearing from view. A moment later, Monique and her group fled through the laboratory door. He swapped to the feed from their street view camera, the one they had left running, inside the apartment. Soon enough, he found the moment the front entrance opened. Monique and Jonas emerged, holding the door open for the others. But the explosion came first. Monique and Jonas were thrown forward, toward the street. He lost sight of them, behind a row of parked cars. None of the others ever emerged. He could only assume they were dead. He sped through the remainder of the video, watching as Monique regained her feet, followed by Jonas. They spoke, or argued, it seemed, for several minutes, before Monique turned and walked away. Jonas followed her, not far behind. Both seemed largely unscathed, though Jonas lagged and glanced back repeatedly. They soon disappeared from the camera's view. Pax checked the time clock on the recording. The scene had been barely an hour earlier. Now what? Pax considered his options, evaluating each with a practiced, ruthless efficiency. But there were too many unknowns, which meant too many risks. Someone else had triggered the explosion. Whether he liked it or not, any action on his part would continue to be compromised until he better understood the larger picture. Which meant it was time to make a call. And get some answers, he thought to himself. He sent a coded message, waiting for the response. It was a familiar protocol, though never before used during an ongoing operation. He wasn't sure what to expect. He didn't wait long. His net phone made the rarest of chirping sounds, a direct call from his employer. "Identify yourself," the voice at the other end of the line intoned. The LED on Pax's net phone turned green, authenticating the caller. It was yet another reminder of the consortium's dedication to security and to anonymity. "Pax, calling with an update, and for further instructions." There was a moment's pause as Pax's voice print and fingerprint were processed and verified.
"Are there any other survivors?" the voice asked. "We lost the signal after the explosion."
I bet you did, Pax thought to himself. But first things first. Two, Pax said. The woman, Monique Durand, and Professor Hansen. They were already out the door. The explosion threw them clear of the building. Neither one appeared to be seriously injured. Deuce is dead. I brought her back to the apartment. I can't confirm the others, but I doubt any of them survived the blast.
Agreed, the man said. But we need to recover the two that escaped. They're a loose end.
You saw what she did, Pax replied. What can you tell me about her, or why she showed up at Hansen Scientific?
We're looking into it. We've got an asset headed to her home. As soon as we know more, we'll pass it on.
For a moment, Pax debated whether to divulge his previous history with Monique. His consortium contact appeared to be unaware of the connection. To his own surprise, he decided against it. Loyalty is a two-way street. Instead, he changed tacks. So the deal I made in the lab wasn't acceptable? There was no immediate response. Pax waited silently. He was genuinely curious to hear the answer.
No, if things had played out differently, we might have settled for that kind of arrangement. But they know too much, and Hansen threatened to sell the asteroid to the highest bidder. He can't be trusted.
I gave them my word they wouldn't be harmed, Pax said. It seems I can't be trusted either.
You promised you wouldn't harm them, and you warned them about your employer. Turns out you were right on both counts.
I'm not sure they appreciate the difference, Pax said. He wasn't sure he did either.
We did what was necessary. This isn't a situation to take any chances. We need you to find them and finish the job.
Pax weighed the man's words. He was right. It was his job. He'd been doing the consortium's bidding for over a decade. They had saved him, in more ways than one, during the operation in China. It had given him a new lease on life, and a new arm. So for 10+ years he had been their loyal soldier. But it was no small thing to break his word. The thought still rankled. He needed to buy himself some time.
I'll finish the job, he said. I'm less than an hour behind them. It shouldn't be difficult. If you pick up anything on your end, send it to me. Particularly anything about Monique Durand.
We'll have someone at her house soon. If you find her before then, wait for our report. You'll have it when we have it. Good luck.
The line disconnected. Pax set his net phone on the window ledge. For a moment he watched the ongoing fire at Hansen Scientific and the events unfolding on the street below. Emergency response units had arrived, and firebots were being deployed into the building. A few lawbots were also on the scene, cordoning off the area and taking statements from witnesses in the crowd. He saw at least two video drones circling overhead. Other vehicles blocked the road in both directions. An unfamiliar discomfort settled into the back of Pax's mind. The conversation with his contact at the consortium had left him in a predicament. His promise to Monique ran squarely up against the instructions from his employer. They had hired him to do a job, and in 10+ years he had never failed to accomplish the mission. And yet, his consortium contact never said a word about the events in the lab. There had been no apology, and barely any explanation. He considered the possibilities. An expert could have placed the explosives in a way that minimized the risk to him in the lab. Or they could have lost sight of him as he activated his suit and assumed he'd escaped. Or perhaps he was simply expendable. A bit of each, most likely. The revelation was more disappointment than surprise. He wasn't quite sure of the implications, but it felt a bit like a fork in the road. He returned to the table. His research computer lay open, awaiting his command. He'd follow instructions for now and see where they led. It was the safest course, not to mention the most interesting one. Let the hunt begin.
2. Somebody just back of you while you are fishing is as bad as someone looking over your shoulder while you write a letter to your girl. Ernest Hemingway. Farhad slipped out of bed in his usual manner, hands gripping the floor as he pulled his body forward until both sets of toes touched down on the worn rug. He took a deep breath, extending his arms and arching his back before lowering his chest again, parallel to the floor. His morning push-up routine helped to get the blood flowing. Today, he reached 50 before he was satisfied. He bounded to his feet, silent as the stars that cast a dim light through his modest home. He dressed, glancing at Ravan askew across the bed, the sheets twisted in a ball at her feet. A smile escaped his lips as he watched the rhythmic rise and fall of her chest. He did his best each morning not to wake her, though, truth be told, some of the best mornings were the ones when she awoke. But he shook his head, putting those thoughts aside. The river called. Dawn was still hours away. This was his time, before the sunrise laid bare the drudgery of his daily routine. Fishing was still fishing, of course, but there was a world of difference between his private pre-dawn ritual along the Sefid Rud and his job as first mate on a local fishing trawler. He savored these early mornings. Nothing took higher priority. Well, almost nothing. He cast a last look back to Ravan as he pulled the bedroom door gently closed behind him. He crossed through the main room of their home, a combined kitchen and dining area. It was small, even by local standards. But Farhad barely noticed. His trusty fishing pole was leaning against the wall, not far from the front door. He picked it up, along with the faded denim jacket hanging on a hook next to it. He was out the door a moment later, toward the road and the river. The Sefid Rud was his river. It flowed north and east for more than 600 kilometers, down the Alborz mountain range in northwest Iran, until it emptied into the Caspian Sea, near the city of Rasht. Farhad had grown up here, in a small village east of the city and next to the river. As a child, he and his father had fished along the banks of the river nearly every morning. Someday he hoped to do the same with his own son. But he and Ravan had been married less than a year. There was still plenty of time for that. For now, her willingness to leave Rasht and settle here along the river was more than enough. He took a deep breath, testing the air as it passed his lips and through to his lungs. He could taste its potential, as if the air spoke to him in some ancient, long-forgotten tongue. He couldn't explain it, how his senses somehow led him to the fish, like a compass strangely attuned to the magnetism of Caspian trout. But it served him well, especially given the ever-dwindling supply. It was rare that he came home empty-handed. Their home was at a midpoint between two sharp bends in the river. The resulting C-shape provided access to several nearly equidistant fishing spots. Today, he turned north, leaving the road to traipse through a soggy rice field and to one of his favorite locations along the northernmost point on the curve. A new moon hung in the sky, along with a few clouds, making the darkness almost complete. Farhad barely noticed. He made the walk in less than 10 minutes, finding his way as if traveling under the midday sun. Before long, he reached the river, and a low, flat stone that protruded from the bank. It was his marker for this location. It also served as a makeshift bench. Farhad found a comfortable spot on the stone, unhooking his homemade spinning lure from the eyelet just above the reel. His fishing rod was ancient, even by local standards. His father had given it to him almost 20 years ago. It had seen several different reels, and a wide range of fishing line, bait, and lures, but the rod itself hadn't changed, having survived all manner of fish, from the smallest of trout to his once-in-a-lifetime battle with a young sturgeon. The rod was part of him. Ravan called it his extended family. With a near-effortless snap of the wrist, he sent the spinner on a lazy arc, downriver and just beyond a small eddy formed by a confluence of submerged rocks and deeper waters. He settled into his routine. To the untrained eye, he might have looked asleep, his rod barely twitching, his body nearly still. But beneath the surface, his spinning lure performed a complex dance. It was a rhythm he had learned and perfected over many thousands of trips, just like this one. A smile crossed his lips as he recalled the last time he had visited this particular location. A couple of tourists had joined him, led by Jalal, another local fisherman. Or more accurately, led by Farhad. Jalal had learned long ago that following Farhad was the best way to find the fish. But instead of homemade spinners, the Westerners brought seeker lures loaded with the latest in nanorobotic video and propulsion technology. The men had programmed their lures for sturgeon, of course. Farhad had watched with amusement as their lines darted back and forth across the river, hopelessly searching for the elusive and all but extinct beasts. And they had watched Farhad as he pulled several trout from the river. He waved each time, giving the men a warm smile after every catch. Before long, the men had abandoned their quest for sturgeon and joined Farhad in the hunt for trout. Farhad shook his head at the memory. In the end, the men caught their fair share of trout, more than Farhad, in fact. But Farhad felt no jealousy or remorse. His joy was in the unmasking of the unknown, and the anticipation that came before the catch. It was a time of self-discovery and unexpected revelations. Watching a video screen as the seeker lure enticed its prey was as foreign to him as his life undoubtedly was to them, and he was fine with that. There was a tug on his line, like a knock at the door. Tap, pause, tap, tap, and he tugged back, gently but firmly. His motions were automatic. The reward? A mid-sized trout. He made quick work of it, reeling the fish to shore and gingerly unhooking it from the spinner. He held it high for a moment, his first two fingers inserted through one of its gills. It was a male. He kept the males, returning most of the females to the river. And it was big enough for a dinner. His birthday dinner at that. His mouth began to water at the thought. What was she planning? Ravan had refused to divulge her plans, despite his best efforts to pry them free. Ravan was as wily as she was beautiful. She had learned the art of a pleasant no at an early age. The menu would remain a surprise, if that was her intent, and it would be worth the wait. She was the daughter of a spice merchant, one of the best-known shops in Rasht. It had caused a bit of a stir when she had agreed to marry a poor fisherman's son from the rice fields of the Sefidrud. But he had eventually won over Ravan's family, just as he had with her. And with both his parents gone, they had become as much his family as hers. He looped the trout through a small stringer attached at his belt. The trout dangled at his side, occasionally twisting in protest. Farhad remained standing, one hand on his rod, debating his next steps. It had taken him less than an hour to catch dinner. He still had a few hours before his trawler left for the day's work. He could catch a few more and perhaps save himself tomorrow's trip. But who was he kidding? He could catch half a dozen more and he'd still return tomorrow. It was his morning ritual, not the chore his work on the fishing trawler had become. Plus, same-day fish tasted better. A sudden string of bird calls broke the stillness, interrupting his silent reflection. Ducks, gulls, heron, too many to identify them all. But before he could react, he was knocked to his knees, as if the fish at his side had become a giant sturgeon, thrashing wildly in a last, desperate attempt to gain its freedom. His hands clutched at the ground as he tried to maintain his balance. The initial jolt was followed by several more, creating a rolling motion not unlike the pitching of his fishing trawler, though these waves were uneven and unseen. Another earthquake. It was the fourth set of tremors in the past 2 weeks. His fingers clawed for purchase, scraping desperately against the rough, barren surface of his favorite rock. But the rock was ambivalent to his peril. Even his river seemed indifferent, continuing its downstream journey with barely an added ripple. At last, the tremors ceased. Slowly, Farhad stood, taking a brief glance at his rod and then the trout still hanging at his side. Neither seemed any worse for wear. He squinted out of habit, trying to peer through the inky darkness. He knew what lay around him, though. The Khazar and Albor's fault lines sliced clear through the Sefidrud Delta, with the latter tracing a beeline almost directly to Tehran. But the last major earthquake had been almost 40 years ago, before he or Ravan had been born. Nevertheless, his older friends remained wary, despite the added precautions that had been put in place. He had taken his own precautions, leaving specific instructions for Ravan. His body lurched into motion, almost before his brain had finished connecting the dots. Ravan. She was fine, he was sure. This one wasn't as bad as some of the earlier tremors. She knew what to do. Their home was a simple, single-story structure, and he had reinforced the walls and roof just in the past few weeks. The odds she was in danger were slim, at best. And yet, his legs churned as fast as the darkness, rod and trout would allow. He knew this swath of land like he knew the river, every hollow, every swale, every tilt along the way. In a few minutes, he was back on the road. He turned south toward the village and his home. Already alarm bells were sounding in his head. There were no lights ahead, nor any sounds, save the continued call of the birds, but they had become muted and distant. Farhad covered the remaining distance in a handful of heartbeats. He studied the nearby houses as he raced down the road, looking for any evidence of damage. The darkness made it difficult to be certain, but nothing appeared to be amiss. That is, until he reached his own home, where he found his front door open, and no one in sight. He barely paused, rushing inside and through to the bedroom door. It was open as well. He skidded to a halt at the threshold, as a sudden apprehension washed over him. In the pre-dawn light, he could barely make out the bed. It was unmade, the sheets still in a rumpled ball. It took him a moment to process what he saw. Ravan wasn't here. How could she be gone? He had been clear after the first series of tremors. The safest place was inside the house, against the interior wall that separated the bedroom from the rest of the home. And yet, she had somehow disappeared. There was no point in searching the house. There was nowhere for her to hide. And the front door was open. Despite his instructions, she had likely gone outside. There must have been a good reason, though at the moment he was at a loss to understand it. He returned to the front room, dropping his fishing rod in its usual spot against the wall. He unlatched the trout from his stringer, tossing it onto their small kitchen table. Even in the dim light, he was almost certain there was no damage to their home. So what had driven her out the door? He stepped back outside. He couldn't see much in the darkness, but he circled the house as an empty feeling grew in his gut. He had weathered more than his share of crises, from unexpected storms at sea to the not-so-unexpected battles to make ends meet. But none of them had put his wife at risk. He was surprisingly unprepared for the images that now flashed through his head. He did the first thing that came to mind. "Ravan!" he screamed. 3. If you could kick the person in the pants responsible for most of your trouble, you wouldn't sit for a month. Theodore Roosevelt. Monique slowed her pace. Jonas had fallen behind again. She could see the soreness in his ribs, written in the grimace across his face and in the way he walked. Occasionally, he used a shirt sleeve to wipe blood from the cut on his forehead. Still, he hadn't complained since they left Hansen Scientific. In fact, they hadn't spoken much at all. The only conversation had been an occasional gesture, indicating the direction to the home of his colleague, Professor Kaito Matsui. She couldn't get there fast enough. She did her best to push thoughts of Bima aside, focusing instead on Tabia and the twins. They were her responsibility now. She would never forgive herself if something happened to them. Bima was already one too many. It was all she could do to slow down, allowing Jonas to catch up. Patience isn't a virtue when lives are at stake. "You okay?" she asked as he reached her side. His only response was to point down the street. She took his cue, trying once again to pick up the pace. She kept a wary eye behind them for pursuit, but also for the opportunity to borrow a net phone. She considered each store, each home, even the occasional passing stranger, but she didn't have Tabia's number. It was in her own net phone, now likely a melted lump inside Hansen Scientific. She didn't regret leaving both of their net phones behind, though. Anything to slow GRI's pursuit. She also considered using Honolulu's public net access, available at several of the street corners. But it raised the same set of dangers. She'd have to log in to do it, thereby exposing her location. Plus, it might look suspicious. The two of them, bloody and bruised, desperately trying to locate a person whose number they didn't know. Someone might connect them to the sirens and to the fire, or they might simply call the police. She couldn't take that risk. And then there was Jonas, who knew how he might react. "How much farther?" she asked, for the fifth or sixth time. She did her best to keep the strain from her voice. "Not too far." Jonas seemed lost in his own thoughts, and his pain, she was sure. Monique wasn't much better. Between her thoughts of Bima and her concern for the three friends at home, there wasn't much room for anything else. "There it is," Jonas said. "The gray house." They had reached another intersection. Jonas pointed to the right, down a narrow boulevard of private homes. It looked to be a sleepy residential neighborhood. Monique hoped it stayed that way. She picked up the pace. To his credit, Jonas did his best to keep up. Still, he slowly fell behind. Monique stopped when she reached the low, nondescript gray home. A half-height, white picket fence surrounded the yard. "He's usually home for an early lunch," Jonas said. "I hope we haven't missed him." He went past her, climbing a handful of steps before stopping at the front door. He slipped his hand between the rungs of an iron gate that covered the doorway entrance, rapping on the door several
Sample complete. Ready to continue?